The big thing to know and really understand about your brain is how it behaves like a very overprotective, very irrational helicopter parent, and it always thinks you're about to die. So it always has to keep you safe from any perceived danger.
Yeah.
And it thinks it's keeping you safe, and what it's actually doing is keeping you paralyzed. So here's the thing, when you overthink something, when you hesitate, or when you feel uncertain, what you're actually doing is telling your brain that something is wrong. And in that hesitation or that gap or that uncertainty, your brain goes, oh dear, something's wrong, panic, panic, got to keep her safe, and it knocks you into paralysis where you will not take action. And that is where, from the brain's perspective, where that self-sabotage comes in.
Welcome to the Reinvent Health Podcast. We are all motivated by meaning, which is why the Reinvent Podcast aims to bring you a wide range of information, focusing on all aspects of physical, mental, and spiritual well-being, so that you can make the changes towards a more meaningful, healthier, and happier life. And now, your host, Nikki Robertson.
This is the 50th episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast, and I'm absolutely thrilled and delighted to be chatting with Leah Seafor, who was my very first guest on the show. Leah and I have been on many TV shows together. We've known each other for years, and what we're going to chat about in this particular episode is self-sabotage and resilience. I really hope you enjoy the conversation. This is the 50th episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast, which was born out of boredom and COVID-19, which is amazing if you think about it.
It is extraordinary. Yeah. It's been amazing watching this podcast just grow and your incredible guests. It's been amazing.
It's been amazing. The guests have been phenomenal. And I was thinking, you know, what am I going to do for the next 50th? Because the initial 50th, I was so gung-ho. I just emailed everybody who I like to listen to anywhere in the world. And most of them came back and said, hell yes, which was also amazing. So it was quite a good lesson in just putting it out there. And I think that's what this world is getting to. If you put it out there and you have the right intention and you want to give people a platform that is where they can really just, you know, say their say, in a very moderated way, just in a fair way where everyone can have their voice. I think it's a great way of communicating.
People actually love doing collaborations.
I love collaborations.
And they love being involved in and meeting new people and expanding their audiences and their awareness.
Yeah.
So I think I've had the same experience, like lots of people. I haven't come across anyone who's really been, you know, no, I don't want to participate. I don't want to do stuff. Like, we are that global community, and I think COVID kicked us into that so much quicker than would have otherwise happened, of how people are just, everything is now online, collaborative, participating. It's been an interesting year to see how it's changed the field of what we do.
Very, very. And in the last 12 months, how would you say, looking back, what has it done for you, for your business on a personal level, on a social level? How have things changed for you?
So for me, my whole practice had to transition online. So there was a lot of resistance in the beginning. I think people have got a very negative perception of what online coaching could be. And they think it's very impersonal and it's very clinical and it's very robotic. And I think it surprised everybody how it's not any of those. It is just as intimate. It is just as connected. People have much less stress because they're not on traffic, you know, driving to the practice and then driving home again, or trying to quickly get a lunch hour to quickly go and have a session. People have been able to manage their time much more effectively. So I found that in my sessions that I've worked with people, I'm having much more relaxed experiences with clients because all that other stress is not happening. And I think that people have focus more on themselves, their family health, their health, probably more than any other time I've known. I think COVID really brought a hard reality check to everybody. And out of that fear, and you know, humans are weird, we need to have fear to drive us to want to make changes or drive us to want to do anything. But out of the fear of COVID, people started paying a lot more attention to their health. And because of being trapped at home, people started paying a lot more attention to their relationships and their communication. And so I've seen people work in a far more constructive, focused, intentional way in their health, their lives, their relationships in this last 12 months than I've ever seen before.
Yeah, I think it's broken down a lot of perceptions for many, many people. It was necessary. We were going along year after year going, something's got to change. This has got to stop. The madness has got to stop. And then it did stop and we went, wait a minute. We didn't mean it like this, but this is what it takes to affect change, to affect the way we think about the world and think about each other. And a lot of things had to be thrown out. The baby in the bathwater in many cases had to be flushed to make way for something new, even if the circumstances we're living in now are not exactly desirable. And there's lots of nonsense that's grown out of this pandemic. It's also brought for many people a new dawn. And I think that really has to be focused on, because it takes the same amount of energy to get morbid as it does to look forward and move forward with your life. So I think that's something we should really be chatting about today is, one is self-sabotage. It's very easy to get yourself stuck in a place and pull up those old habits that you know don't serve you. So from the NLP, from the coaching point of view, let's dive into, and we've spoken about this on other platforms, is what is self-sabotage? And we all do it. I think from Tony Robbins to Mandela, everybody self-sabotages in one way or another. And the trick is recognizing where you're doing it. So what are your sort of top line thoughts on what it is and what we can do to start working away at that?
So self-sabotage is when we are actively or even passively taking steps to prevent ourselves from reaching our goals. And I think that one of the biggest ways we all do this is procrastination. So I think that we procrastinate, we put it off until tomorrow, Monday, we're going to start the diet. Oh, I'll do it next month. I'm a prime guilty person of that. I constantly procrastinate my way through my life. Another big way that we procrastinate is with self-medication, with drugs, with alcohol, overeating, and just an inability to commit. So I think the self-medicating and procrastinating are the two biggest ways that I see people self-sabotage. I don't know, you see it hugely in your field.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to eating plans and having to change healthy behaviors.
Of course, there's always a reason why I don't have time to exercise or prepare food. Frankly, we've all got the same amount of time. It's just, if something is important enough to you, you do it. And if it's not important enough, you find an excuse. And I think that's where we start, when we start realizing that it's self-sabotage. It's not boss sabotage, husband sabotage, mother-in-law, it's self.
Yeah.
We are actually driving our own bus, and it's our inability often times to communicate to people in our lives that we need X, Y, and Z so that I can resource myself, so I can be a better person in our relationship as an employee. And we don't think about it that way. Nobody ever thinks about self-resourcing.
And nobody really takes the time to truly learn how their brains work and to truly investigate the subconscious stuff that is driving our behavior. It's one thing to consciously know that you sabotage. We all know that we sabotage ourselves. Everybody. I sabotage myself all the time. But why? And that is what is really important. And I think for me, what the big thing to know and really understand about your brain is how it behaves like a very overprotective, very irrational helicopter parent. And it always thinks you're about to die. So it always has to keep you safe from any perceived danger.
Yeah.
And it thinks it's keeping you safe, and what it's actually doing is keeping you paralyzed. So here's the thing. When you overthink something, when you hesitate, or when you feel uncertain, what you're actually doing is telling your brain that something is wrong. And in that hesitation or that gap or that uncertainty, your brain goes, oh dear, something's wrong, panic, got to keep her safe, and it knocks you into paralysis where you will not take action. And that is where, from the brain's perspective, where that self-sabotage comes in. So you know, I know that I hope many of the listeners have read Mel Robbins' 5-second rule, where she speaks a lot about this, a lot about how you've got to beat your brain's panic reactiveness to just get into action and do something. Because if your brain gets its way, you're just going to be paralyzed constantly.
Yeah. I think that also speaks to becoming the observer, that place where you can see yourself thinking the thoughts, even if it's for a couple of seconds where you can pull out of the chemical process of your brain and see yourself going through that, just long enough to go, wait, it's what is thinking these thoughts and are they true? And what if I did it anyway? It can be quite ethereal.
There'll never be a time that you feel okay to do something if you're trying to do something that's risk-taking or getting out of your comfort zone. And we kind of wait until there is this mythical right time, you know. I think people do this a lot. When is the right time to have a baby? When is the right time to buy a house? When is the right time to start that new business? There's no such thing. But constantly waiting and that hesitating, it is the delay process. Hoping that the time will come where there's no fear is what we've all got to learn to get over. Fear is going to be there no matter what you do. Even if you're Tony Robbins, who has stood in front of hundreds of thousands of people over so many years, I can guarantee you there is always an element of fear in him just before he steps onto that stage in front of people. So I don't care how experienced or inexperienced you are in life, every single person has fear, and learn to own it and learn to integrate it into your next step, like be energized by it as opposed to being paralyzed by it.
I love that because, you know, fear and excitement are, say, co-joined twins. They are the same feeling with a different accent. And then you start to understand that feeling you get when you're scared is the same feeling you get when you're super excited. And you decide, I don't want to be the scared feeling. I want to be the excited feeling. Then you're suddenly in control of your outcome. And I find that so powerful because we can replicate that anywhere in our lives, just pulling back and going, this is simply, I'm at a crossroads. I can choose to feel this, feel it deeply, but put a smile on my face while I'm feeling it or throw up. And the choice is always yours. So if I had to come to you as a client and I had an eating disorder, I couldn't stop eating sugar or drinking. Let's use drinking as an example. I'd become habituated into having not one glass of wine every evening, which is okay, a bottle. And this is not uncommon. And I'm self-sabotaging myself and I hate myself for doing it. How would you as a therapist deal with me in this self-sabotage example?
Look, it's a hard one when we're talking about drugs and alcohol because I work with an addiction specialist that I'll refer people to for the reason of how addiction to that degree really affects you. Chemically, it affects you on a whole lot of other levels, which is addictive behavior. And I work in conjunction with her. But all I would ever do when I start working with people is really get you to understand the subconscious behaviors that are driving this. Like, what is really going on that's making you pick up the third glass of wine that night, even though consciously you know you shouldn't be doing it? So for me, there are a few points, there are a few very recurring subconscious speed bumps that stop people, which triggers self-sabotage. Let's talk a bit about them. So obviously I think the first one is always a lack of self-esteem or self-worth. And, you know, that negative self-talk, constantly telling ourselves that we're not smart enough, we're not good enough, we're not qualified enough. You know, when we constantly talk in a way to ourselves, what our brains actually want to do is it wants to align. It wants to align so that how we are thinking and how we are acting is the same thing. So if we keep thinking something, our bodies want to act in alignment with that. So we literally talk ourselves into not being good enough, not being qualified enough, not being successful enough. And then, of course, we have that lack of self-confidence. And any lack of self-confidence is going to stop you taking that next step or achieving anything that you want to achieve. So it's important to understand that your actions are always going to align with your beliefs and your values. And Nikki, I think you do this a lot with your work, is getting people to understand, like, what do you believe about yourself? What do you believe about this, and what are your values underlying this?
Yeah.
Because if your values and your beliefs and your actions are not aligned, whichever one of those is the most powerful, the others are going to sink to. And we are very powerful at negative self-talk. We are very powerful at putting ourselves down all the time. And then our actions and our values are going to align with that. So this lack of self-esteem goes very deep. And, you know, when, you know, we have to overcome this by starting to look at the victories, the accomplishments, the small stuff that we can acknowledge. So acknowledging our behaviors, being in a state of gratitude, looking at the wins is how we slowly start wrangling ourselves out of that negative self-talk into something positive. Because it's hard if we I see this a lot of people use affirmations. People try and use affirmations to overcome a feeling of lack of self-worth. So they'll read a sentence stuck on their mirror going, but I am worthy and I am loved. But deep down inside, they don't feel it at all. You know, deep down inside, they still feel flawed and worthless and incapable and deficient. And this is when you get that lack of connection, of in my heart, I feel rubbish. And in my mind, I'm trying to lie to myself to tell myself I'm actually worthy. So that would be a very first big step, is let's unpack your values, your belief systems, you know, your self-talk. What is going on there? That would be, for me, would be a first step for us.
Yeah, and because we have this innate negativity bias, which is tied so directly into survival, it is there to keep us alive, although it doesn't feel very lively or positive. It really is our hardwiring, a negativity bias. So it takes conscious work, preferably with somebody who can help guide you through it, to pull yourself or your thinking onto a different lane. And we can't do this alone. Very few people have the training, the tools, the background to understand how to do this on their own. Human beings are tribal for a reason. Yes. We should be there for each other. We should be there to pull each other out of these holes that we create for ourselves because of our innate wiring. And I think one of the biggest steps that I've discovered personally, but I've seen very often with people, is our inability to ask for help. But what we're doing when we ask for help is we're empowering somebody else to come onto our team. And the person we're asking for help very, very often feels very, very grateful and honored that you would see them as important enough to invite into your life. And this
perception thing about asking for help is also acknowledging you don't have all the answers. You don't know all the ways. You don't know what you don't know. And you're in the state that you're in. You're drinking that bottle of wine every single night because you actually have not learned any other coping mechanisms. You haven't learned how to think differently. You haven't learned how to behave differently. So, you know, people delude themselves when it comes to drinking and drugs to go, no, I've got this totally under control. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not a drug addict. I totally know what I'm doing. People really delude themselves into thinking that they've got the self-control to get out of that situation, which we know they don't. Mm. So you don't know what you don't know. When you can go, you know, I don't know, and I really need support to show me another way. That is one of the greatest acts of self-empowerment you can engage in, is inviting people with different knowledge to teach you so that you can elevate and evolve.
Yeah, I love that. When I first started in radio and on live radio, you get bombarded with arbitrary questions that you never see coming. And one of the techniques I learned really early on was to say, I don't know the answer. And I thought, how on earth, here you are supposed to be an expert on radio, everyone's looking to you for advice. And I got into the habit of, instead of winding myself up about having all the answers, was to say, I don't know, give me your details, I'll get back to you, I'll find out. Mm-hmm. And just being able to do that got my brain into a state where I really relaxed, and I was able to articulate what I did know so much more coherently. And it was the first step in, for me, in public vulnerability, and it was a freedom. And so many of us are terrified of being vulnerable, especially publicly. I mean, that's not something you do. But wow, once you put yourself in that position, you realize it's a freedom. I think Brené Brown speaks about being vulnerable and the power that comes from vulnerability.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought this particular topic up, because this ties very much into another subconscious thing that drives self-sabotage, which is imposter syndrome. And imposter syndrome is this constant worry that we are not qualified or good enough to do what we want to do, and that we're going to ultimately be exposed to some fraud. So when I say to people, you know, this fear of success, you know, fear of success is a really big thing when it comes to self-sabotage. And most people can't immediately snap back, well, like, why would I be afraid of being successful? Well, think about what comes with being successful. What comes to being successful is having to be in front of people, having to own who you are, having to own your message, having to be in front of a platform and claim some authority over a subject. And that is what really and truly terrifies people. So, you know, when we've got that fear of doing that, we're then going to start engaging behavior that's going to sabotage our success and going to limit our success. And we do that, like, as we're getting close to a goal, we will then start doing things that are going to take us out at the knees. You know, we'll forget to send the email, or, you know, oh, we accidentally miss that online, you know, that Zoom call, or, I know that I was supposed to submit that on time, but I've missed the deadline, and oh, well, you know, I guess I can't get it now. So we start doing little things, because then it means nobody's going to expect anything of us. And, you know, I go to a lot of talks. I love speakers, and I love hearing, you know, about different things. And what's interesting for me is how a crowd reacts to a speaker who stands in a position of arrogance and superiority, thinking that they are the ultimate knower of the subject. And that when people from the audience ask questions, they kind of either shoot them down, or they give them a bit of a scoff, and they go, well, you know, you clearly don't understand the subject. Or that turns people off so hugely from respecting that speaker. But the best speakers that I see are exactly what you were talking about. The ones who stand on the stage and go, you know, I don't have all the answers, and I don't know everything. And I'm actually pretty positive that there's a lot of people in this audience that are smarter than me, more educated than me, know more about this subject. So I'd love to invite you guys to participate in a conversation about this and tell me, you know, what's going on. And the people in the audience will never see that person as being small, as being limited, as being, you know, an idiot who doesn't know what they're talking about.
Sure.
Because like we said at the beginning of today's call, you know, it's about collaboration. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows everything about a subject. Nobody.
Yeah,
so impossible. That vulnerability is the biggest way to overcome imposter syndrome, is to kind of go, you know, I may not have all the answers, but I'm just putting myself out here with what I think I do know. And like, if there's anyone there that would love to correct me, awesome. I'd love to receive that feedback. And it just nails that imposter syndrome instantly.
Yeah, it takes away the fear. It really does. Yeah. So, you know, branching from imposter syndrome, which is, it's rife among women, especially highly qualified women in professional arenas, who are in the spotlight all of the time. And let's just trickle into the topic of resilience, because it is a buzzword out there at the moment. You see resilience hashtag everywhere you're looking. I don't think people really understand what resilience is, because it comes from vulnerability. Its roots are in all of these things we've just spoken about. What does it take to build a resilient human from the ground up? And this is tricky. And what is resilience anyway, in your opinion?
Look, I think that a summary for me of resilience is simply learning healthy ways to manage any adversity so that you can cope better with the unexpected. So resilience is about training yourself with a set of skills that is going to give you the psychological and physical strength to overcome any unexpected setbacks, shocks, and derailments in life, because they're coming, whether you think they are or not. And, you know, if you are not building a pool of skills, when that stuff hits you, you drown, or you just go paralyzed, or you go into reactiveness. And reactiveness is a very unhealthy way to respond to unpredictable life events.
Yeah.
But resilience is about learning that psychological skill set that, you know, a bomb can go off, figuratively, literally,
yeah,
and you have an ability to observe the reality of what is going on right now and choose a healthy response instead of falling into an unhealthy reaction. No,
this is sure. Having the emotional ability to ride the waves, because life is going to throw you tsunamis. And it's almost, you know, on one end we can scenario plan in our heads, when this happens, what are my options? And literally play out scenarios so that when one of those events happen, we're sitting not in paralysis, but we're sitting in choice. That's one. I think another way of building resilience is working on your emotional fitness, your physical fitness, your immune fitness, so that when these impacts take place, you have got the resources on a chemical level to stand up and take the hit and recover. So if we're teaching ourselves to recover from running, and we're teaching ourselves to recover by sleeping, and we're teaching our immune systems to recover because we're resourcing them with good food, then we are equipped to deal with almost anything emotional and catastrophic that the outside world will pound at us, and it will pound something.
all the time. Something is always going to come. I mean, there's a few, so like one of my big ways, and you'll know this with NLP, one of the biggest ways of dealing with resilience is learning to reframe any situation to look for the possibilities and lessons out of that situation. So we are always only viewing reality through our single filter of what we believe reality to be. But if you've got an ability to shift perspective and see that same event from a very different perspective, you may come away with a different understanding, a different lesson, and a different possibility of what that event could mean for your life. And, yeah. You know, I don't think that, you know, pre-COVID, if anybody had told us what our COVID life was going to look like, most people would have gone, oh God, there's no way I could do that. There's no way. And yet you never know what you're made of until you have no other choice. And COVID hit and we were all just plunged into having to figure it out. So I think that, a big thing is that came out of COVID was really learning how to focus on what you can control and not getting hysterical about all of that stuff that you can't control. And this for me is one of the biggest things that builds resilience, is that I know chaos is going on outside of me, but I am totally in control over how I'm thinking, speaking, behaving, acting, that I can control. And you know, the chaos will always exist. It's your choice whether you want to dip into that chaos and let it, you know, absorb you, or whether you've got that powerful buffer between you and chaos, which for me is what resilience is, the buffer that things will always happen, but you are always prepared.
Yes. And I think that's, you know, we go back to comfort zones and why they're dangerous, really, especially when you've got children, is to try and push them out of their comfort zone and try new things all the time. If you hate running, get a coach, make peace with it, find a way to get something that you naturally pull away from to work for you, because it's not about the running. It's about the neuroplasticity in your brain, your way of finding a way around something that you perceived as unpleasant. And that is an exercise in resilience, is finding a way around. And
that thing you're talking about is what I call intentional stress.
Yeah.
And intentional stress is a big one. It's a bit like exposure therapy. So intentional stress is, you know, if you're scared of heights, go and do a bungee jump, or go and, you know, do a tandem jump out of an airplane. You know, if you're terrified of spiders, go to a facility where somebody can teach you how to hold them and see how you can move through your fear of spiders. If you've got a fear of public speaking, you know, go and do a webinar, or go and do a Facebook Live video. Just put yourself out there, because we won't know until we do it. And because we don't know, our brain will always go to worst case scenarios to prepare us for the worst possible thing that could totally happen, which of course never happens. You actually do it, you know, I remember my first Facebook Live. I mean, I've done this work. I'm going into like 27 years of doing this work in the world. I speak in front of people all the time. And I mean, I was sweating bullets when I had to do that first Facebook Live video. And like, oh, what if I mess up and this is live? It's not pre-recorded and I can't edit it. I got myself into such a bloody state about it. And then I just did it. And you know, it's like, you know, I almost want to turn back to my brain after that event and go, what is the matter with you? You know, why did you get me into such a state before I did this? So I think that immersion therapy is powerful at building resilience, because it's like it's overcoming all these irrational fears. And Nikki, I think that's a big thing, is understanding what's a normal fear and what is irrational fear. Yes. And irrational fear is what it disintegrates our resilience and it drives self-sabotage. So maybe you want to speak a bit about normal fear versus irrational.
Yes, let's do that. Let's talk about how to identify, because when you're in it, in the middle of the night, you can't differentiate. You wake up in the middle of the night and all these events are playing out at a particular time in your circadian cycle where you can't tell the difference between reality and what you've just dreamed up. So how do we tell the difference between real fear or irrational fear?
Look, I think real fear is the obvious stuff. Like, are you under attack? Is something happening? Is there a threat to your immediate survival? Like, that is fear. Like, are you putting your hand on a stove and damaging your skin? That's a fear, you know? There's a sound outside at night? That's a normal fear to have. So anything that can be perceived as a threat to our actual physical survival, I think, is healthy, normal fear. Don't drive too fast on the highway. You know, don't leave a child unsupervised around a swimming pool. Like, those are normal fears.
Visceral fears, yeah.
Absolutely. irrational fears have everything to do with being driven from your brain, like internally. And there's all these thoughts, these worst case scenarios that you drive. Well, I could go and ask that girl out, but what if she laughs at me? Well, you know, I could go and start that business, but you know, there's so many competitors, and what if I'm not good enough? You know, well, you know, I could go and take a loan from the bank, but then what if my business collapses and I can't repay? You know, it's all these what if scenarios that we drive in our heads. Those are irrational fears. There is absolutely no immediate threat to your survival. Nothing is coming to harm you. You are just creating the stories in your head. I would say that the time of night you're speaking of is probably one of the hardest times to get out of that reactive fear where you think someone's standing in the corner of the room, and it takes your brain a while to go, no, it's just the curtain. You know, in that moment, you genuinely believe you're under a threat because somebody's standing in your room. And the problem with that fight, flight, freeze response is the whole, and you can talk about this, the whole physical reactions that go on when you hit that fight, flight, freeze response and how long it takes to get out of that. So, of course, nobody's going back to sleep after they think there's a man / curtain in their room, because that once that fight, flight has kicked in, oof, it's a long time to just calm and regulate your entire system. So how do you tell people to manage that?
Yeah, so look, the middle of the night thing is it's crazy. The first thing you do when you wake up in the middle of the night is turn the light on so you can create some perspective. And I think that's kind of a metaphor, is turn on the light so you can create perspective, whether that light is talking to somebody, it's weighing up your options. If you're afraid of your financial situation, turn on the light by talking to a financial advisor. You know, if you're lying in bed in the middle of the night and you think there's something in your room, turn on the physical light. But we've got to, again, bring in our resources to take the imagined fear into the realm of the earth, the physical, and create choices. And a lot of our stress is caused by the fact that we perceive that we have no choices. And it's perception. There's always choice. There's always a choice whether to turn left or turn right, stay in bed or get up and run. And you know, but this comes back to self-talk, and this comes back, it loops all the way back again to NLP. What are the conversations we're having in our heads, in our private dark space where we haven't turned on the light? And those conversations we're having with ourselves turn on inflammatory cytokines in the brain, which create disease in the body. So again, how do we know we're doing this? What are the conversations that we're having with ourselves, and whose voice is it anyway? That's my favorite.
I love that. I love that metaphor of turning on the light. I just love that, because it's so, so true. We don't know what we don't know. And look, for me, breathing and breath work is a very powerful way to stop that fight, flight, freeze response.
For sure.
I think very simple ways that when you take very deep breaths that kind of activate that vagus nerve that we've got, it just starts to regulate all of your body systems. And then it brings your cortex, your frontal cortex, back online, which kind of has gone into a little shutdown with fight, flight, or freeze, so that you can actually consciously think rationally about what is really going on. And when you stay in that panic, you can't. So learning breath work. I think that journaling before you go to bed, like brain dumping, is a very powerful exercise, because we let all these subconscious fears build up through the day, and we just need to vomit that stuff onto a piece of paper and go, right, this is my fear. Okay, well, what could you do about this tomorrow? What plan of action could we put in place? Let's activate that stuff, because then you can go to sleep and your brain is not churning over it like a dog with a bone.
Agree.
And then when you wake up the next morning, you've got a plan of action to go. So that's another technique I find very helpful.
That's my single most favorite tool, so you don't have to ruminate all night. And don't put the piece of paper there so that when you wake up, you can write it down. Yeah. Write it down before it wakes you up and deal with it tomorrow. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And this is, again, coming back to inviting people in to support you to see and learn a new way of being. Because here's the thing. When you do not learn healthy coping mechanisms, when you are not actively building resilience in a healthy way, what is going to happen is that when the unexpected stuff hits you, you are immediately going to default to unhealthy coping mechanisms. And those are always alcohol, drugs, overeating, gambling, work, social media addiction. Name your poison, you know.
Distraction.
And this is what it's easier. And look, I have to say that the biggest problem that has been in our lives for however long it's been now with COVID, over a year, is that there has been no escape. Like, let's say things were really bad at work. You could go to the gym after work. You could go out clubbing with your friends. You could go out for a meal to a bar and have a drink with your partner. There were a whole lot of other ways you could cope with that single area of your life that wasn't working for you. And this is why everybody has plummeted into such radical depression and such real mental health concerning behaviors during COVID, is there has been no solution. I can't drink. I can't go out with my friends. I can't escape my family by going to the gym. I can't escape by going to the office. I can't buy cigarettes for the longest time because people, you know, are addicted to their cigarettes. Like, all our exits, all our safety exits were gone. And it's like we had to just sit in this overwhelm of what was going on. But it was good because, yes, for me, it was showing you all the stuff you had not been facing in your life. And now it's up front and center and you've got to face it.
Yeah.
So, but I do understand what was driving people's hysteria a lot through COVID was this inability to remove yourself from that uncomfortable feeling.
Yes.
So that's the danger of not building resilience, is that you will, yes, end up using that stuff to cope.
Yes, it has brought out all the worms from the woodwork, and it's also given us some incredible life lessons about being able to go in to escape the outside when we need to, if you've chosen to be conscious. And, you know, and choosing to be conscious is something that transcends education, income level, ethnicity. It's doesn't take a level of sophistication or privilege to make a choice to go inwards and to have a different perception. I mean, the poorest people in the world, the in India, are the ones who created this concept of Zen, of going inside to escape the madness and the disease and the anarchy that they live in all the time. You know, going inward was never something that was created in Silicon Valley. Let's put it that way. The people from Silicon Valley had to go to the sticks to figure out how to, yeah, access that part of themselves. So it is a magical thing that is accessible to all of us if we get to that point of desperation where we need it most.
And it's simple.
It's so simple. It takes work.
You don't have to do some whole course about it. You don't, no. You know, and look, the advantage of what's happened in COVID is the huge abundance of stuff that is online for free in terms of webinars and podcasts and videos and free workshops around all of the stuff that we're speaking about today. So they're really, if you have got connection to the internet, you have got absolutely no excuse to say, I don't know how. There are just so many people offering such amazing volumes of work to support you finding better skill sets, better ways of breathing, you know, living, communicating, relating. And go and seek those out. You know, you've got, you know, always one of the big things I do with my clients is get them to do a real social media cleanse. Never mind, you know, a detox from a health perspective. And what that detox, I'm not one of those who's going to vilify social media. I think social media has actually saved people's lives in this last year, quite frankly. But what I'm saying is, choose and be very selective about who you are following on social media.
Absolutely.
Because you can unfollow all the news. Yeah. You can follow all of these, you know, sites that just drive you fully with anxiety and get you riled up and get you upset. Or you can follow comedians. I'm a big fan of laughter. Laughter, yes, is a huge way of relieving a lot of stress.
Yeah.
Follow self-empowerment people, coaches, therapists, speakers, authors. And there's a huge amount of them. And you know what? I let people go, well, I don't know who to follow. Let's say Tony Robbins. We've spoken about him a few times. Tony Robbins, Brené Brown, Jay Shetty, Robin Sharma, Mel Robbins. There's five names for you. Go and follow those. What we know about social media is that when you follow one, you're going to get recommendations to follow other pages that are in alignment with that work. Yeah. And fill your social media feeds with empowering stuff that makes you feel that you're learning stuff and building that skill set versus, yeah, all the stuff that in a very small mental place.
I agree. I got rid of all the news channels, everything that was negative. And it was amazing how it's a happy place now just to go and check out who's doing what good in the world for whom. So yes, again, it's an example of how you can control your inputs, and controlling your inputs and who you choose to socialize with virtually and physically is a critical ingredient to mental health. I mean, you can't change your family, but you can choose how you interact with other people. both online and in person. And that, you know, I think also we don't consider the small steps, the things that we can do right in this moment to make our worlds or the world a better place. It always has to be this macro vision on a big scale. It's not that. It's each one person just being conscious of what they're doing in the moment, which creates this ripple effect. And that's when things start to change. And it's critical that we get that right.
And the quickest thing to do right now is to take a look at the desk. Take a look at your desk, your work desk, and clean up your rubbish.
File your papers
away. Set everything up. Give it a good clean. Yeah. If your workspace is impeccable, move on to the next desk. But like my big thing is you clear up your external clutter, it's going to clear up your internal clutter.
I agree.
In terms of your process. So,
yeah,
you know, please just do a bit of a glance over your home, sort out your kitchen, repack the cupboards, fix up the lounge, repack your cupboards. You know, a big one that I love doing is going through your wardrobe. And really, guys, we've all got the COVID kilos. Please let's not have half of your cupboard dedicated to clothing that does not fit you, that you open every day and you look at those clothes and go, one day I'll lose weight to fit into that. Guess what? You don't fit into it. And that one day ain't coming because you know yourself better than that. So get rid of anything that doesn't fit or make you feel beautiful in your wardrobe. Donate it. There's a huge amount of charities that need those clothes rather than them just sitting in your wardrobe week after week, month after month, gathering dust. Just clear out your space is a big first step that makes you feel clearer in yourself, makes you feel empowered in yourself, it makes you feel energized. Yeah. And then with that extra energy, we can come back to your desk and go, right, am I ready to do that blog post today? Can I create that video? Can I make that phone call? Can I send that email? You know, can I deliver that communication? Guys, it starts with clearing up your external space. That's a good one for me.
Yeah, external space is a metaphor of your internal processing. I agree. You couldn't have said that better. So we are heading to an hour and I really want to get into your new book and what it's about and when it'll be released and everything that led up to what it took to write a book, because it is difficult to do and well done. That's all I can say.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so completely excited. It was a very big process. So I've known I've wanted to write a book for a long time. And because I procrastinate, that's my way of self-sabotaging, and I'm so completely rubbish at holding myself accountable, I decided to work with the amazing Sarah Bullen, who is the writing coach. And I signed up to work with her and Kate Emerson, and they drilled us through a write your book in 100-day program. So I already actually had a good half of my manuscript before I started working with her. But, you know, when you've got some external accountability going on, you're going to get stuff done. And I needed that for myself. I needed somebody else to kind of whip me into action. So the book was then done last year. I'd finished writing in, I think, March. And then, you know, the biggest process is putting it out there, putting proposals out to publishing houses. You know, you want to get a publishing deal. And, you know, for anyone who's interested in writing a book, you know, Sarah's an amazing person to work with just in terms of her unbelievable knowledge. But there's this big thing of like, do you self-publish or do you go with a publishing house? You know, do you want to get the contract or do you want to do it yourself? And it was a very long journey deciding all of that. But throughout that process, I was very, very, very honored to get a publishing deal with Tafelberg Publishers and got an incredible editor to work with who's worked with me solidly since I started. That was, I think, in October last year. So this process is interesting because you think you've got a manuscript and then an actual professional editor gets hold of it.
Yes. You're going to spend
the next 6 months pretty much rewriting your whole book. So it's been such an education, learning about the publishing world, and Tafelberg have been the most unbelievable team to work with. I couldn't have asked for a better group of people to work with. And then it gets exciting with the layout people, and then you get the book design done, you know, the front cover. And so it's all completely done, and it will be published on the 14th of June this year. So we're just over a month away from publication date. Mm-hmm. And the book is about communication. It's about communication systems. It's learning how to communicate effectively with the people in your life. It's learning what the major communication problems are, you know, how you can overcome those. So it's like a book/workbook that helps you to really learn a new way of communicating. And I can't wait to share it with all of you.
Yeah, congratulations. And may it be the first of many. So, Yes.
Indeed. I'm already on my second manuscript. So yes, well, it's a bit of a bag.
Yeah, it is. Once you know, like anything, once you know you can do it, then there's no excuses. Just do another one. I don't know if it gets easier, but you can't stop. So...
It sounds a bit counterproductive because I am a coach to say, don't keep your eye on the end game. But I feel that when it comes to something huge like this, when you keep thinking of what has to happen for that end game to arrive, you get into a total overwhelm. So I think you've got to keep your focus. You know, one of my favorite things to say to people is stay on the day that you're on. It doesn't matter where you're supposed to be by next week. It doesn't matter where you're supposed to be by next month. Today is the only time there is. Stay on the day that you are on. And if today you can only sit down and write 500 words, if today you can only eat one healthy meal,
yeah.
If today, you know, you can only have one workable communication with somebody in your life, it's great.
It is.
That's enough.
And that is what you have to aim for. Yeah.
One.
Just do one.
You can't go to bed at night going, you know, but I could have done more. Well, you didn't. So just
I agree.
This was the best that I could do today. For some people, the best they can do is actually getting out of their pajamas. And that's a big deal for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, please honor the state of stress and trauma and shock we are still in because of COVID.
Yes.
And these unrealistic expectations we put on ourselves to have to accomplish all this stuff in a day or a week or a month. Just get off it.
Yeah.
Just be... honor who you are, where you are for this phase of your life, and do one thing at a time. Yeah. So stay on the day that you're on.
Yeah, I love that. Do what you can with what you've got now and forget about it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Leah, for being my 50th guest. And I'm hoping, I know you will be, on many more episodes of the Reinvent podcast. And here's to another incredible 6 months coming up, because I know you're going to have lots of fun with your book coming out. And who knows where it will go, but yeah, it's going to be good. That I know for sure.
Well, I love being here with you. I love working with you. And I know that we've got some exciting offerings coming up, you and me, in terms of an amazing course that's going to be coming up in Johannesburg in May. And we will be sending those details out to everybody. So I just love working with you, Nikki. I love the work you do in the world. And
thank you.
And thank you for inviting me here today. I've loved our chat.
Thank you for joining me for what has been yet another informative and interesting show. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to subscribe. And if you're listening via Apple Podcasts, please rate and leave a review, as well as share with anyone and everyone you know. Until next time, look after yourself and do at least one thing each day that makes you smile.